Hello and welcome to episode 103 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grunislav, and with me, as always...
Hello. I'm the wind.
I see. Who are you really?
Windy? Blowing. Hi, Francisco.
Hi, wind.
The wind, thank you.
Hi, the wind. Blowing.
Yes. That's my surname, yes, that's my full name.
I see.
Thank you for observing my correct title.
Good. I see this New Year is already off to a fantastic start. Happy New Year, by the way.
Happy New Year.
Yes, it's now...
To all of our listeners.
Yes.
If you're joining us for another year of... Well, whatever you
whatever it is,
what it is we do.
Yeah. Yeah, how have you been? We haven't podcasted since, I just checked, we haven't podcasted since before Thanksgiving. I know Thanksgiving's not an Australian thing, but how were your holidays?
Mine were good. I got to see a lot of people, which is always nice. You know, I don't really do the Christmas thing, but I got to do the family thing, so that's pretty nice for me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a couple of days off work and just relax. Went to the beach, which is a very Australian thing to do at that time of year. Which,
hey, I went to the beach.
But, I mean, you were in Miami, so...
Yeah, last year I went to the beach on December 23rd, so...
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Did you go to the beach this December?
I did not.
Despite being in Miami?
Yeah, my mom was sick, so I didn't really get much of a chance
to...
Oh,
that's a shame.
Yeah, she had a stomach thing, so I didn't really get much of a chance to really, like, go out anywhere. And
when you said she had a stomach thing, I was like, that's just called a stomach. You don't have to add thing on to it.
She's got a stomach thing in her body.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but it was, I mean, I went to Boston for Thanksgiving, which was fun. I mean, not right. For Thanksgiving, but I was in Boston. I was actually coming back from Boston on Thanksgiving.
Hang on. You say now that it was fun, but I recall that when you were there, you're like, oh, I hate traveling with these people.
Hush, they might listen to the podcast.
They won't listen to the podcast. They're too busy singing lame songs.
You're right. No, it was good. I enjoyed it. It was just, yeah, some travel companions are better than others, and certain travel companions I had in my family were not so... They didn't have the same priorities as I did. I like, when I go places, I like to, you know, get up and go and not take...
Yes, I'm very much the same.
7 hour showers in the morning and...
Well, 7 hour shower rhymes.
True.
Not that that proves a lot, but it's something at least.
I suppose. Anyway, yeah, so Boston was a good time, and then I went home. Boston,
you mean?
Yeah, I mean Boston. I packed the cat. Haven't yad.
I meant Boston. These.
Oh, oh yeah, right.
Come on. What sort of podcast is this? Let's think.
You're right. Although
I don't do accents. I do nerd references.
Yeah, I know. Boston.
Well, I do an accent constantly, but I don't do any other accents.
Yeah.
This is Get with Ben 304, aka The Wind.
The Wind Blowing. Yes. I thought that it was very fun, and it was nerdy for me because I was walking around the sites that I had seen in such video games as Assassin's Creed 3 and that award winner.
That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I know. It's mine, too. It's an award winner. Achoo. Assassin's Creed 3 and Fallout 4. I was following the Freedom Trail. There's actually a quest in Fallout 4 called Follow the Freedom Trail. And as soon as I got home from Boston, I loaded up Fallout 4 and I walked around and I was like, oh, I understand this a little bit better. Although the geography is not 100% accurate. It's fairly close. Same with Assassin's Creed 3. Actually, Assassin's Creed 3 is a lot more historically accurate, believe it or not, than Fallout 4.
Yeah, no, I can believe that. It seems like they put a lot of effort into getting stuff not, I don't want to say accurate, but at least the right sort of feel.
Yeah, you know? I know. I was being sarcastic. But it was actually kind of funny because I stopped to have, well, we wanted to have lunch, but then we ended up going there later for evening drinks and dinner at this tavern called the Green Dragon, which was advertised as being the headquarters of the Sons of Liberty. So basically we're like...
That's cool.
Sam Adams and all those guys met up to plot.
Yeah.
And when I went back and I replayed a little bit of Assassin's Creed 3, like, the meeting place that you go to and get a bunch of missions from is the Green Dragon. So I was like, oh, that's cool.
Did they get the interior right?
Well, no, because
it's changed a lot.
It's changed, and it's also changed locations. The place where the Green Dragon is right now is not the same location where the original Green Dragon was, but it's okay. In the same general vicinity. The Paul Revere house looks exactly the same, though, which is pretty cool.
Hmm.
Yeah, so, and the Old North Church.
I mean, we've talked about real-life locations in video games on this podcast a long time ago, and said how cool it is, but it does stand true. It is cool to sort of feel that.
It's especially cool when you can climb them and jump off of them into conveniently placed haystacks.
Yeah, and sit on a bench to magically hide.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah.
If only it was that easy to get away from your family.
No.
Anyway.
So then I went home for the holidays, came back here, New Year's, etc., etc. And yeah, that's
here
all. Here we are.
Hello.
Yeah, good. So,
did you play any games?
I did play games, as a matter of fact.
How about sharing with the class?
Yeah, well, I will, Mr. The Wind. So, I actually got two games for Christmas. And I haven't played... What? I haven't played either of them.
Well, you're still playing the games that you had.
Well, here's the thing, though. So the two games I got for Christmas were Dishonored 2 and The Last Guardian.
Yes. And
I haven't even taken the shrink wrap off of The Last Guardian. But, which, by the way, I got The Last Guardian via Edmundo, friend of the podcast, I think. Anyway.
I think. We'll see.
I don't know if he listens. He'll probably tell me. But yeah. So Dishonored 2 actually comes with a code for a free digital download of the Dishonored Ultimate Edition remaster that they did for PS4 that comes with all the digital all the DLC as well as remastering the original game. So I redeemed that and I downloaded that, and that's really what I've been playing. I haven't played Dishonored 2. I've been playing the regular Dishonored. Because it comes with...
Well, it's probably good to refresh.
Yeah, it's good to refresh, and I like Dishonored, and I mean, I compared the two, because I loaded one up on my the one on my PS3 and PS4. I was that guy. I was like, let's see what the graphical comparison is. And...
That was a great voice.
Well, that's what people who care about that sort of thing sound like.
AKA you...
I don't care about that sort of thing. I was just curious.
You just did it.
Yeah, but I didn't do it to be like, oh, this is an inferior product. This is not a good remaster at all.
I demand a refund for this free thing that I've been given.
Pretty much. But yeah, I mean, obviously the textures are slightly sharper and there's less... I don't know. I'm not a graphics really connoisseur, but it looks nicer, I guess. But the thing
the technical analysis.
Yeah.
It looks nice, I guess.
I mean, the loading times are slightly less, which is nice, because Dishonored had kind of on the long side of loading times. And, I mean, it's got the DLC, which is cool. It's got the Dunwall City Trials, which is basically a set of challenges that you have to complete. And, there's also two actual story DLCs where you play as Dowd, which I haven't checked out yet, but I'm interested in checking out. Because apparently the stories tie into Dishonored 2, so I guess it's good to...
Okay.
Yeah, it's good to sort of get the whole picture before moving on to the sequel. But I do definitely need to move on to the sequel, because... Actually, that segues into another little brag that I can talk about, which is a development that happened since our last podcast, which is I'm going to be speaking on a panel at GDC. And the reason that I bring it up is because Kara Ellison is on that panel as well, and she worked on Dishonored 2, so I feel I should play it before I meet her and be like, so that way I can be like, oh, I enjoyed Dishonored 2, or, oh, Dishonored 2 was terrible, what were you thinking? I wouldn't actually say that to her if I felt that way. Because I'm not an asshole. I mean, I am an asshole, but I'm not that much of an asshole.
I see.
So, yeah.
I think, like, honestly, the main thing that I'd want from, like, a game that I had on PS3 that was moved to PS4 is basically just smoother frame rate. Like, that'd be it. You
know? I heard that apparently it's not smoother frame rate because it's locked at 30 frames per second or something like that, but I didn't really notice.
Okay.
I don't really care. It doesn't make a difference to me on PS4.
I mean, locked is fine. There's some that aren't locked in that drop. And dropping frame rate is what I'd mostly look for a fix of.
You know? Anyway.
So, yeah.
What have you been playing?
I've been playing a lot. Mm. That doesn't surprise anybody. But I have been playing a lot of games. And I'm trying to remember what I've played, what it's been since the last podcast, but I'll do with what I can remember. I played a game called The House of the Dying Sun.
You posted lots of screenshots of that one.
I've told you pretty much all the games that I've played, so none of these will come as a surprise.
Okay, I'll just quietly eat my bagel then.
Okay. And House of the Dying Sun is basically TIE Fighter remake with nicer, more modern graphics. It's got the same sort of simple 3D models. It's got the same sort of you're a bad guy plot. A lot of people said to me, oh, it's like Wing Commander. It's not really like Wing Commander. It doesn't feel like Wing Commander. There's less of like the characters that you meet and stuff. Everything's sort of replaceable, but it plays great. The main campaign is pretty short. I finished it in a couple of hours, but then you can go back on harder difficulty levels and harder difficulty levels then with like challenges and stuff like that. So it kept me pretty busy, and I'm still playing it now and then, like just trying to finish more challenges. I've been playing One Shot, which is like an adventure game, but in like the RPG Maker style. And it's interesting. It's very meta. And I'm not that great with the walk around style, you know, in the RPG Maker thing. So I find some of it a bit bland, but some of it's pretty cute and pretty good. So I got to finish that. I've been playing Sub-Level Zero, which is basically Descent, but a roguelite, and that's what I'm playing at the moment, and that's cool. I like that a lot, and I finished it once. I played 8-Bit Hordes, which is basically voxel Warcraft, and that was good. I finished both campaigns in that, and that was pretty fun. And it's got, like, sort of gold medals and silver medals that you can go back and get. So I've enjoyed going back and getting some of those.
When you say both campaigns, you mean basically, like, human and orc?
Yes, that's correct.
Is it actually human and orc?
Yes, that's correct.
Oh. So then I guess it's basically Warcraft. It really is like Warcraft then, yeah.
The guys have made three games, these people. They've made, but in this series, they've made 8-Bit Armies, which is basically Command and Conquer. They've made 8-Bit Hordes, which is basically Warcraft, and they've made 8-Bit Invaders, which I'm told is basically StarCraft. So, you know.
Interesting.
But I think Invaders only has two factions, not three.
Hmm.
So, not quite StarCraft. But I also played I played Milkmaid of the Milky Way, which is a point-and-click adventure game. I liked it. There are a couple of things I wasn't so hot on. Most of the game was cute. There's a couple of moments in there that I went, oh, no, I don't like that, in terms of narrative and just a couple of things that seemed a bit off to me. So I went, that sort of soured it. But mostly it was cute. You know, it's a lighthearted thing for the most part, but it's got some pretty dramatic moments. And, you know,
soured it, eh?
Yeah.
That was
dramatic moments. You know, how the games get everyone upset.
No, I was just pointing out the use of the word soured in a game about a milkmaid.
Oh, I see. Yes. Well, there's a point where you have to do that.
Oh, well, there you go.
But yeah, you know, it starts off pretty lighthearted. You know, all the dialogue rhymes and stuff, and it's pretty cute. And then it gets kind of nasty, as adventure game plots have a habit of doing. Because villains and that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some of the puzzles had me scratching my head for a while, but mostly I thought they were pretty fair. The only thing that frustrated me was there was one or two spots that were hard to remember where to get to because the room exits were hard to spot. So that was a bit frustrating.
Hmm.
And that had me stuck for longer than I would have been otherwise.
I see.
What else have I been playing? Oh, just today, tonight for my Friday night little treat, I bought A Tale of Chaos with 1C, colon, Overture, which is a point-and-click adventure game.
Okay.
And I played some of that. I will say straight up that English is probably not their first language.
Yeah, I watched some guy's video let's play of it, and it seemed interesting from a gameplay perspective, but there were certain things about it that I was just kind of like, interesting.
Hmm.
Mostly the sort of repetitive talking to themselves on every screen cycling dialogue thing.
Well, that's adventure games, buddy.
Well, I mean, there's like one screen where you come back to and every single time she starts off going, I'm so excited! There's an adventure waiting for me or something like that.
Oh, but honestly, when you're playing the game, you don't look at that because you're looking around for how to solve the puzzles.
Right, okay.
Like, I know that that's there, but it's not voiced, so I'm not looking at that. Sure. I'm looking at stuff to click on. Yeah, it's there in the background. It's probably different when you're watching it.
But yeah, yeah.
I honestly do not notice that. I know it's there, but no. Right. I don't see it as being a problem. But, you know, in terms of the writing, like I said, English is probably not their first language, but the jokes are still landing enough that I've been laughing noisily. So
okay.
That's pretty good. It's one of the most honest adventure games ever. It tells you straight. It reminds me of Catmouth Island, and it knows how silly adventure games are and just has fun with it, you know.
Right.
If you don't like comedy, like, if you're sad and old, you probably won't enjoy it.
Hmm.
But if you still have some warmth left in your heart,
then I probably won't enjoy it.
Well, yeah, we know that. But, you know, some of the puzzles I've had to use pen and paper for, they're pretty. I don't know how much you watched of it.
I sort of watched the entirety of the first episode, and then I kind of skimmed the rest, and I watched the ending, and, yeah.
Oh, right, yeah, no. I don't know why you don't just play games, they're so much more fun. Anyway.
Because I'm poor and lazy.
Okay, that's fair. but yeah, so that's... Have I missed anything, Francisco?
I don't know, I feel like I've missed something, but probably not, because I don't play as many games as you do. So I feel so like...
The problem is that... That it's been a long time, and I don't write down what I said on the last podcast.
Been a long time, huh?
Been a long time.
Uh-huh.
So, it's got to be more to it than that, but I don't know what it is. Anyway, that's the main stuff, and for anything that I've forgotten, I'm dreadfully sorry.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting for me, because I really like a rich and varied sort of diet of gaming. I like racing games. I like sports games. I like sort of shooting games. I like flying games. I like everything. And it's been really cool. The last few months, I've been picking up lots of indie games. Oh, no. I forgot about Seasons After Fall, which is like a puzzle platformer. It reminds me a lot of Ori and the Blind Forest, but easier, basically, and less frustrating. So that's about as quick and as accurate a review I can give.
I want to get Inside. I just learned of its existence.
Great.
Yeah, I just learned of its existence over the break, and I was like, my friend was like, have you seen this game Inside? And I was like, yeah. I mean, actually, no. He asked me about Firewatch first, and I was like, yeah. And he's like, have you seen Inside? I'm like, I've heard of it, I think, I hadn't heard of it. So he showed me.
I'm having trouble following you here.
I don't remember. Basically, he said, have you seen Inside? And I said, no, I have not seen Inside. Show me. And so he showed me the trailer, and immediately, as soon as I saw the trailer, I was like, this reminds me of Limbo. And then it said, from the creators of Limbo. And I said, I see. This is why it reminds me of Limbo. But then I watched more. Yeah, then I watched more, and I was like, oh, wow, this really looks good. I really should get this at some point. So that's on my list.
It's funny because you mentioned Firewatch, and just before you mentioned Firewatch, I remembered that I played through Firewatch.
You did play Firewatch.
Hmm.
How'd you find that?
I liked it. I liked the dialogue mostly. You know, obviously the visuals were great.
Hmm.
But the dialogue was fantastic. Like, some of my favorite dialogue in a game ever. It was snappy, it was funny, it was interesting, and, you know, it did all the right things in all the right spots. The plot, I wish, was a little different. You know, they relied a lot on... I can't say anything, or it'll spoil it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I like the... It's one of those games where It happens in a lot of games where the dialogue is just superb and the inter-character stuff is superb and the plot itself is just, it's okay, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But it was interesting in that, you know, it purports to be a game about exploring a big environment and you pretty quickly familiarize yourself with the environment. Mm-hmm. So you stop getting lost pretty quick,
yeah,
which is cool.
I mean, you have a map the whole time, which
What's that, sorry?
I said you have a map the whole time, which helps. But I
They rely on you following the map, but by the end of the game, I basically knew where to go.
Right.
Like, you know, like... And I really like that sort of learning a game world feel. Yeah. You know, that's something that I quite like.
I like the fact that you could just... that you had to use the map to figure out how to get places, where it wasn't just like a compass, like, follow this arrow to the next objective type thing. You actually had to find your way.
It's kind of interesting in that it's a deconstruction of the modern sort of thing where you always tells you where to go. You know, obviously I play lots of old games, and old games do not tell you where to go.
Right.
You know, you figure it out, and if you've got an auto map, you use that. Otherwise, you're drawing maps yourself. Mm-hmm. Which is something a lot of people don't have the patience for, I think, anymore. Mm-hmm. And in some games I don't, and in some games drawing a map is really satisfying to me. It really depends on the design, you know. Might and Magic 1, for example, is really fun to map out because the designs are specific and each new area's got little patterns and you start to recognize a pattern as you map a place out, and that's really satisfying. Mm-hmm. Other games, not fun to map out at all. I have the Beholder is frustrating to map.
And that's saying something coming from you who loves mapping, so.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like anything. People say, oh, mazes are bad, mapping's bad, everything like this. Some mapping's bad, some mazes are bad, in my opinion, you know. Mm-hmm. Anything badly done is bad. It's sure. Pretty obvious.
Well, that's, yes. That's kind of the definition of bad, but yes.
There's stuff that frustrates me. You know, people hate the King's Quest V maze, and I can tell why, because the camera angle changes. That's really hard to deal with.
Sure.
You know, Inherit the Earth has got the same.
Yeah.
When you're not dealing with that, it's not that hard to map a thing out.
Mm.
It's pretty quick and pretty fun. You know, so, well, fun. Here's the thing for me. This is what I always say. This is what my sort of way of looking at it is.
Hmm.
If I was on a real adventure, I'd be writing a map out. I'd have to. So right. For me, I'm just like, well, this is part of my adventure,
mm-hmm.
You know? And I sort of joke with people sometimes that, you know, oh, I want an adventure, you just want the guided tour, you know? Which is fine, and I get that, you know? For example, Kelsey, when she plays a game, she's there for the story. She's, you know, puzzles and that, okay, but most of the time they're getting in the way,
mm-hmm.
You know? So I think it depends on what you're playing for. And to me, I'm playing to explore an environment a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love character stuff. I really do. But I also love environment exploration stuff, and I don't see why we can't have both.
Right.
So, yeah. But, yeah, Firewatch was cool.
Good.
I got off on a tangent there. I'm very sorry.
That's
never happened before. And hey, it will never happen again.
Speaking of tangents, why don't you tell us what our topic for the week is going to be?
What our topic is for the week is... related to something I've been doing lately. Kind of the last couple of weeks, I've been looking at scenes from old adventure games, mostly Full Throttle, because I've been going through one a night and sort of trying to figure out what makes it work, what stuff's weird, what stuff's good. Mostly it's good. Full Throttle's one I picked because I like it a lot, and I knew it would be kind of easy to analyze because there's not many weaknesses in it, you know? Mm. Which helps a lot, because I'm better at going, this looks good because of this, than trying to find all the wrong things in images, which is hard work.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but also I've been, you know, doing a couple of blog posts, one of which I just posted a couple of hours ago, and where I look at adventure games scenery with regards to specific things in mind and try and analyze, you know, how does this work as an image? The visual language of adventure game scenes is something I've become really interested in, because there's a time in any conversation about art where someone that's not an artist will usually say to me, oh, yeah, but you can't just learn art. You have to know how to do it. And I'm always having this conversation where I go, no, you can learn how, you know. If I set up two vanishing points for you and show you the technique, you can draw a basic boxy house in an hour. Mm-hmm. I promise you, if you follow the rules, you know. And I'm trying to break art down. You know, I love drawing by feel, and I drew by feel for years. But on days when feel doesn't work, like, you got to step back and go, all right, this isn't working. What can I do to make this work? What have I done wrong? What am I missing? So I'm looking at other people's work at the moment and trying to figure out what rules have they followed that work? What stuff, what common themes, you know, are in this work? And people sort of tease me because they're like, oh, you know, you put a lot of, there's always a triangle, there's always thirds. And I'm like, yeah, that's because it's a repeating theme. It's not just stuff, it's not just a thing I saw. I'm like, and it's a coincidence that there's a triangle of features in an image. It's in every background in Full Throttle because it works, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Even if Peter, and this is the thing, I can't read Peter Chan's mind. I don't know what he was thinking when he was drawing these things, but I can see what's in the image, whether he was doing it consciously or whether it just looked good to him, you know? That's the important thing, I think, to remember. I can't tell you he was thinking this when he did it, but I can tell you this aspect does this because of this, at least to some extent. So basically what I'm hoping we can talk about, well, what we're planning to talk about, is taking inspiration from other people's work, especially particularly art, because we haven't done an art-specific podcast for a while.
No,
we haven't. And what you can learn from looking at other people's work.
Okay. Have you published that new blog post you mentioned, by the way?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I haven't read it yet.
Okay.
I'll have to look for it.
One of the scenes in there is the one that inspired it, which was one that you linked me to the other day, which was from Conquest of the Longbow.
Longbow
is a shooting term.
You mean the bedroom in the sort of like, in the abbey?
That's correct.
Yes. When did you publish this? Let's see here. I'm searching on Twitter, blah, 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 blah.
Just go to my blog. You know where to find it.
I don't know where to find it.
Oh, go to thewind.com.
Thewind.com. Oh, here we go. The red, green complementary palettes in adventure game scenery. Right. Oh, look at that. And you've got a scene from Gabriel Knight, which is...
What's fun?
I can talk about Gabriel Knight a bit.
What's fun is if you compare that scene to the next one there, which is the scene from Sherlock Holmes,
yes.
The use of complementary colors is identical, and yet the scenes are incredibly different.
Yeah, I sort of saw that. How about that? Well, Sherlock Holmes seems a lot more monochromatic to me than the Gabriel Knight.
Well, sure, and this was something that Trolls was saying. He said, why is it so flat? And I said, it's because of the smaller value ranges.
Yeah.
You know, if you turn it to gray, which if you follow that conversation, you can see that I've taken the hues out and just turn it to gray.
Yeah.
There's a massive difference.
There's no contrast. There's not much contrast in the Sherlock Holmes one, whereas in the Gabriel Knight one, there's way more.
Right. It's small value ranges that's doing it, and I'll take a look at that later. But
yes.
Basically, that's a good example there of him looking at a thing and going, why does that feel flat? Mm-hmm. I mean, the other ones don't feel that flat, and you can look at the art and compare them and say, well, this is the difference in this one. You know, that's really cool that you can see someone's, not mistake, but see a weakness in their style that other people have done in a more, you know.
I always wondered about that game. Did you ever play that, the Serrated Scalpel? No. The thing about that game is, like, the palettes of the sprites change constantly based on the room that they're in. But the sprites, I guess they must have done some sort of tinting thing, because obviously they wouldn't have done copies of the sprites. But
maybe it sounds like it's just the sprites reading the background palette.
Yeah, basically.
And using that information.
But the sprites themselves have so many pixels, like, they have such little subtle value ranges that it's ridiculous, like, how much effort that must have taken to animate. Because normally, like, when you and I do sprites, we usually use, like, maybe a 3 or 4 color ramp per color.
You use more than I do, usually.
I use, like, maybe one more than you do. You sometimes get away with, like, 3. I generally use, like, 4, maybe 5 sometimes for skin tones. But
skin, I've been up to, like, 7, but it depends.
Yeah. But for clothes and stuff, I usually use, like, 4. But Sherlock, I mean, Sherlock and Watson, their outfits are basically all one color. But within that, there's like 8 different color ramps of the same, like, just gray or whatever, off purple or whatever they use. And it's just, it's really strange to me. Same with their faces. They're orange, but they have this really weird, yeah, I don't know. Anyway. What were we talking about? Yeah.
But the interesting thing, you know, it's interesting, especially studying Full Throttle, because there's a thing that happens when you're learning anything where you'll hear a theory, and you're like, oh, I guess that's the theory behind it. Uh-huh. And you think, well, is this correct or not? When you actually find the practical application of that theory in something that looks good, suddenly the theory has a lot more weight to it, you know. I remember in mathematics class, a lot of the kids were like, you know, we were doing calculus. Mm. And the kids were like, when am I going to use this? You know, this isn't useful for anything like that, you know. And it's more enjoyable, and also you learn it better if you can see something in action in a practical situation, you know. I do anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You sort of, and when you can pull a scene apart and every single background in Full Throttle, not every single background, but most of those backgrounds can be split up into thirds neatly with points of focus on one of the junctions of two thirds, all of a sudden the rule of thirds doesn't seem that stupid, you know. And you can do this with old landscape paintings, which I've done for years.
Yes.
But old landscape paintings aren't set up the same way as an adventure game background. They don't have walkable areas. They don't have hot spots. So to do it directly to the thing that I'm doing is more empowering to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So basically I'm trying to find theories that I've learned and theories that I've applied to my own work, and seeing how these theories have been used by other people in the same sort of image type that I'm trying to create for my job. And right. For my, you know. So, and it's interesting, you know, some of the theories, I've learned some new theoretical stuff. I don't know if you saw, but if you look on my Twitter, you'll see I posted a comparison with a Full Throttle scene to an Edgar Payne sketch, who did a great book on landscape studies.
Yeah, I saw that. The Tower.
And it's the same thing. And, you know, it's weird because I was up at 3 a.m. and I was talking to Ivan Ulyanov about the thing. And I'm like, this is a reverse. This is an anti-Steelyard. This isn't how they're supposed to work. This doesn't make any sense to me. Why would you draw this? And I just put it down to the fact that, you know, well, it's an adventure game. It's got to be like this. But the next day I was kind of really frustrated that I couldn't figure this out. So I went digging through Edgar Payne's book, thinking he's got that many different variations. He's bound to have something. And found basically the exact same composition in his work with an explanation of the idea. And I went, that's cool. That was a real moment of, you know what, these old landscape guys, their stuff, even though it's not the same.
I'm curious about something. You said you were freaking out because you said it was an anti-Steelyard. Why did you consider it an anti-Steelyard?
Because it follows the exact opposite principle that a Steelyard composition follows.
What's a Steelyard composition?
I think you need to do some composition study, my friend.
Oh, okay.
It's one of the most common forms of composition.
I see.
Yeah. So, there's a bit of homework for you.
Yeah, okay. That's too Google.
Yeah, but... Well, don't do it now. Do it when you're in a learning mind frame. Do it when you're paying attention.
I am paying attention. Just not to you.
Oh, dear. But yeah, it's...
I'm kidding.
It's interesting when you see... When you have an idea of this is how this works, and you see someone do it backwards, and you think, okay, he's broken the rule, and it... There must be a reason for it. So, yeah... That was a real interesting moment for me to sort of deal with that. And, you know, in game context, I can see why it did it. And it was weird because most of Peter Chan's compositions are so rock solid that to find one that went backwards to the logic that I had thought was cool, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So here it says that a Steelyard composition uses the natural distribution of forms based on size, starting with the larger size element, which should always be closer to the center of the painting, and a smaller one, which should be placed far from the center in the opposite direction.
Right, so if you look at the tower in the Full Throttle scene...
It's off to the right. Have
the small focal element is towards the center of the screen, mm-hmm. whereas the large focal element is off to the edge, so you're giving one focal element twice as much weight.
Right. Okay.
So, yeah. But anyway, I won't go into too much detail because it's pointless to talk about images unless you can see them.
That's true.
And we're doing a podcast.
Yes, we are. So I just want to say that I enjoy reading your scene analyses, and I think it's very interesting. But also, it makes me realize that I have absolutely no clue. If I were to do a scene analysis, I probably would probably because I haven't studied as much theory as you have. But I really wouldn't have much of a clue where to begin outside of, like, maybe looking for triangles and maybe color something. But yeah, I'm not as aware of these things as you are.
I mean, we've been to art galleries together. You've seen me. I take a long time to look at a picture. I don't,
yes.
You know, it takes me a long, long, long time to do these studies of an image.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to explain. It's a long process. You know, I look at it before I start work for the day, and then I'm thinking about it while I work all day long. Mm-hmm. And then I get, you know, to the end of the day, and then I sit there, and it takes me from half an hour to 3 hours to do one of these sometimes.
Wow.
When I'm trying to, I'll miss stuff, you know. I'm like, oh, that's different. And then I'm looking up stuff about it. And then, you know, I sleep on it. And then the next morning I check through it to make sure I didn't miss anything and somehow manage to miss all the spelling mistakes that I make and get posted anyway that I later regret. And then that's life. And then,
I suppose.
Yeah. So it's a long process. You don't just look at a picture and see it. That's always what frustrates me in art galleries is you see people walking past the paintings. And, yeah, there's some shit paintings in art galleries, you know, but you can't – in terms of an artist, I get that people don't go to an art gallery to analyze stuff. But for me, you know, to actually see everything in an image takes time. It's called study for a reason.
I would say that most people go into art galleries to look at the paintings and feel good about themselves, that they're being cultured and they're seeing paintings that are – important, but they don't really understand why they're doing it or what the painting is.
Well, you don't have to understand visual language to appreciate a painting. You'll get an emotional reaction from it, hopefully, anyway.
Sure.
You know, so that's a different thing, but it's frustrating to me if I'm with other people and they're like, oh, let's go to this one now. I'm like, well, I'm still trying to learn from this one, you know. A really good way to start for me, everyone's different. A really good way to start is to set up your Photoshop. If you're looking, obviously you can't do this in an art gallery. I try and do it. There's a couple of ways to do it in an art gallery, but I'll talk about that later. But a really good way to start for me is to set up your grid in Photoshop so that when you press Control apostrophe, I think it is, you get a grid of thirds over the image. And the first thing that that does is let you check for thirds, obviously. But the other thing that that does is it breaks the image up into 9 different parts. And you can start looking at each one of those parts. And then there's less distraction.
Photoshop automatically generates a grid if you press Control apostrophe?
Yeah, you have to set it up in your preferences.
Oh, okay. Because I've just been using a grid that I made myself, and I just copy and paste it into things.
Yeah, I do that if I'm trying to show people on the internet. But most of the time, you go into your preferences and you can set it. You just set it to 33.3%, and then you have it over there. It's much less, you know, of an obstruction. Okay. And, yeah, you can break the image up into 9 different parts, and then you look at what's in each of those 9 different parts. That's a great way to start, because suddenly you're not distracted by a whole image. You're distracted by 9 little tiny parts of an image. And you're like, well, this part of the image is really bright. This part of the image is really dark, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great way to start looking at things. You know, there's more green in this part of the image. There's more red in this part of the image. Mm-hmm. That's a great way to start analyzing. Otherwise, like for me, it's too much. I can't take all that image in at once,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Sure.
It's too much. So by splitting it up, you give yourself at least half a chance to go, all right, this bit's cool. This bit's, you know, this bit's empty. Why is this empty? Why is this full? What's going on here? You know? So, yeah, that's a great way to start. Other cool ways to start are to strip the color out, because color can be very distracting.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at an image in the pure values, that is just grays, black, white, and grays,
mm-hmm.
you get an idea of where the darks and lights are without being distracted. And sometimes hues and saturation can distract you from whether something's bright or not and distract you from form. And form's pretty important. as I've talked about recently. So yeah, that's a great way to analyze it. If I'm in an art gallery, I'll do a few different things. One is try and measure stuff with my hands. I'll get my hands and like try and split the image up and like cover up part of an image while I'm looking at it.
Yes,
it looks
I've
like
seen
you're doing a weird Madonna dance from the 80s, but that's okay.
Yeah, I've seen you do this in art galleries, and it's always amusing.
You're an artist. People think you're weird already. It doesn't matter. You know. So yeah, that's the other great way is get your phone out, and a lot of times phones will have.
Yeah, when you take a picture, you can set a grid.
Right. So you just hold your phone up and you look at the pictures through the phone, which is much less weird because people are used to people taking pictures of the paintings. And you can actually sort of see then, right, I can see a grid of thirds. You got to hold your phone steady. It's not great. Sometimes I'll even take a photo and convert it to black and white on my phone. I've done that in art galleries. And just, you know, it's using the same tools as I use in Photoshop. It's just a slightly different format.
It's like you're playing some sort of painting analysis ARG.
I guess. that's a very modern way of analyzing it, but it's true.
Well, yes. Yeah. I wouldn't say it if it wasn't true.
You know, there are two ways to start looking at it. And I will say this, you get better at anything with practice. You know, if you've never really done a careful study of an image before, and it's your first time, of course it's going to be hard.
Yeah.
You know. And also, I think people are like, oh, I'm going to study art, so they look at 40 different pictures. Like, oh yeah, I'm getting a lot of study, and that's doing one thing well. In any case, like in any situation, is usually more beneficial and more educational to doing, you know, 15 things. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, if you do a careful, considered study of a painting. I promise you, you'll see stuff that you've never seen before, especially in an adventure game background where a lot of the time, you know, you've been distracted by the cool writing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the music, the animations, the characters on the screen, they're a massive distraction because our eyes always follow the character.
Sure.
You know, so when you start taking that stuff out, you start taking the puzzles away. You're not like, oh, how am I going to solve a puzzle in this room, you know, or... Even if you're replaying a game, you've got your favorite bits, so you're always waiting for that cool joke. You're not looking at the things as carefully as you could be. I've played Full Throttle enough times that I know it pretty well, you know. I'm seeing stuff that I've never seen before in that game, you know. And I think that people that have, you know, there's people that have said, you know, oh, I never noticed that in the game before. And I'm like, well, neither did I, you know, because I never looked. I was busy enjoying the game. But now I'm trying to split the game up into a specific component, and that changes how you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And, I mean, not only am I finding it incredibly, incredibly educational, you know, it's going to change the way how I draw. Well, you know, I wrote the blog post I wrote last weekend, somebody commented and said, this is going to change how I draw. Adventure game seems forever.
That's good. It's a good compliment to get.
And, you know, honestly, I feel the same way because I'm seeing how important certain things are and seeing people do things that, well, people, one person do stuff that I knew about in theory, but I had never seen it done in an adventure game because I'd never looked.
Right.
Now I'm looking, and it's really empowering, you know. And I kind of think about how you got started when you were trying to learn to draw for adventure games and stuff. You went to Sierra Games and copied them, basically, you know, and you learn a lot from that.
I mean, I still do. I'm kind of...
Yes, I know.
Like, the current way I'm doing scenes for Lamplight City is basically... Gabriel Knight with what I've learned from James Gurney and composition things I've learned from talking to you. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing.
You were just telling me the other day about, you were like, oh, you're fond of hidden light sources now. I'm like, yep, I use them a lot because I learned it from James Gurney and I think it's cool.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see you starting to put that in your art, whereas before your lighting was fairly flat, you know.
Yeah.
And suddenly you're having fun with lighting, which is cool to see. And it is fun to go, oh man, I've got a new technique. I want to use this.
Yeah.
I want to put it into, you know.
Sure. I mean, like, it's funny because sometimes, you know, like before I would draw a scene and I wouldn't really take too much into consideration how it was lit. So, you know, if I noticed at all, I'd be like, oh, this needs a lamp or something or some light source. Otherwise it would be a dark room. So like I'd just throw in a lamp or something. But the other day I was drawing a room and I had, you know, it was basically a shoebox, even though I try and stay away from shoebox rooms. But sometimes, you know, if you can make them interesting, you can draw shoebox rooms. It's all right. And so I did this shoebox room and I had some interesting stuff on the side walls, and most of the interesting stuff was is against the back wall. This is just a sketch, of course, because I haven't actually drawn it yet. And then I had a pretty interesting foreground object, and then I realized, oh shit, I don't have any light sources in here. And before, I probably would have been like, okay, well, let me just put in a lamp, and I would have put in a lamp or something hanging from the ceiling that would have covered up more some of the interesting stuff and just ruined the composition and the balance of the scene. But now I was like, oh, well, wait a minute, the window can just be on the wall that we don't see, and I'll just put the light of the window showing on the floor like I've done with so many other backgrounds, and there you go, there's your light source. So that's a little technique that I learned that I wouldn't have known if I hadn't studied.
Yeah, and like you were saying, sometimes putting a light source in where it's logical in real world terms to put a light source in will actually mess up your composition. And knowing a bit more about composition, you're like, well, I want to draw attention here, so that's the bit that's going to be the lightest.
Yeah. You know? I don't know if this necessarily relates because it's not a 2D environment, but I was actually having a conversation last night about light sources and placing them in environments to sort of highlight things. And we actually brought up Dishonored. And Dishonored does this a lot where basically when it wants to draw your attention to something in this room, in a room anywhere, it just literally just drops a spotlight on the ground and points it at the wall or whatever it is.
Which I mean, kind of a weird thing. Since Doom.
Yeah, true. The thing that bothers me about Dishonored is if you stand in front of the spotlight, your character doesn't cast a shadow at all.
But that doesn't matter.
It bothers me.
Well, you code that in AGS and see how you go.
Yeah, well.
Right.
Dishonored isn't made in AGS.
But yeah, it's interesting. You know, obviously 3D is very different.
Sure.
But the point is that the way of drawing someone's attention to something is contrast. It always has been.
Mm-hmm.
It always will be. Contrast basically means that it's different to stuff around it.
Yeah.
And that applies in all visual forms. It always will, you know. So in 3D stuff, I can't talk about stuff like composition and framing because I don't know. I got no idea how that works in terms of level design. That's way beyond my field of knowledge. But lighting and color, oh, of course they use the same sort of ideas we use. It's contrast, you know, and even like shape contrast and stuff like that. So, yeah, you can draw inspiration. I mean, if you want good examples of framing and stuff, watch a film. Watch The Thing.
Yeah, sure.
You know, the same with color. You know, watch Fury Road. Watch, you know, a film that's a strong use of color.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see, you know, I was talking about red, green, complementary colors today. Watch The Matrix and how they have the woman in the red dress who stands out from a film of green like crazy, you know?
Yeah.
Anything like that. So, obviously it applies to greater fields than adventure games. The reason that I've started looking at adventure games is because I've spent a couple of years really pulling apart classical paintings. And there's a point where I've learned about as much as I can with my current level of skill from those paintings, and now what I want to do is look at how playable scenes do it, because that's more practical for me, you know. On Thursday I posted an analysis of a full throttle scene that is a fence and a door.
Yes.
And a fence and a door is about the most boring thing you could ask someone to draw.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at what Peter Chan did to that scene, it is incredible how much life, how much diversity, how much detail, how much sort of skill and creativity he applied to that one scene, and the myriad of small techniques that he used to make things stand out. You know, if you go and look at that scene, there's a bit I pointed out where the tower off in the distance, the dark side of it, the sky is light behind it, the light side of it, there's dark cloud behind it, and it really frames this shot beautifully. And I was just sitting there looking at this scene thinking, he's put more work and love and thought into this scene that is a fence than I've done to incredibly, you know, way more, well, environments with way more potential, basically. You know?
Excuse me. Yeah, I should look at that scene because I actually need to draw a scene that's very much a fence and a gate with something interesting in the distance.
If you want to do it, that's the perfect scene to look at, because it is. It actually made me feel very, you know, there's moments when you realize just how good someone is, and you're like, oh man, I knew that they were good, but I didn't realize how good they are.
Yeah.
The last couple of weeks has been like that for me with Full Throttle, and sort of realizing how much further I can advance myself if I learn and follow these principles.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
Good.
And, you know, people have said to me about, oh, you're going to do this game, you're going to do that game. I picked Full Throttle because I knew that Peter Chan was tight. I look at his line drawings on his website. I look at his work, and I know that he's extremely competent. So why wouldn't you try and learn from the best first?
Sure.
Yeah.
Good.
Good.
I don't really have much to contribute to this conversation.
Which interests me because, you know, when I look at your early stuff, it was basically you trying to be Sierra.
Yeah.
You know? Well, not early stuff, but your middle stuff.
Yeah. I think a lot of people do that, though. They just...
I agree.
They take something that they like and they try and emulate it as best they can. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, you still see it in a lot of the, like, Heroine's Quest.
Yeah.
You know, Quest for Infamy.
Yeah.
You can see, people still doing that.
You especially see it in Order of the Thorn.
Yes, you do. I mean, so that's pretty obvious that that was going to be a King's Quest fan game at one point. Those art assets.
Yes.
Which, you know, I think is cool that they repurposed those assets for something original.
Hmm. So, I mean, I don't know. It's weird. Like, I remember trying to, like, emulate sort of, without great success, trying to emulate the sort of deluxe paint Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis type thing, which I've seen a lot of other fan games do as well. not with much success either. But, well, it's difficult to achieve something if you're not doing it in that exact program, I think.
Yeah, or if you don't have a comparable program.
Yeah. So, don't know. But, I don't know. What were you going to say? It's interesting because of looking at my middle stuff, I'm trying to emulate Sierra. Yeah, I mean, I was...
So, obviously, you took things from those games where you're like, well, this interests me. You know, I know there's one scene, I think, in A Golden Wake where you copied the bookcase from King's Quest VI in the foreground.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
You know, obviously, there's stuff like that where if someone had told you to do that and you'd never seen it before, you're like, well, how am I going to do this now?
Sure. I think with me, it was more without having, I mean, not having an understanding and not having an analytical mind about the sort of thing. It was just kind of like looking at things and being like, oh, that looks cool, but not really understanding why it looks cool or the technique that was used to make it look cool. It was just kind of like, okay, well, I'll take this and I'll emulate it myself.
I think that's part of maturing it as an artist is you go from vaguely trying to copy something to specifically going, I like how they do hidden light sources, let's say.
Right.
I'm going to try and do that. Yeah. So, yeah, that's interesting to me that there's two forms of copying. One is a vague aping of technique.
Yeah.
Or overall look, and one is looking at specific elements and trying to repurpose those elements for your own use.
Yeah. definitely.
Hopefully I haven't alienated anybody with technical art. I don't think so. I've been too technical, but
no.
It's hard to know when you're that close to it.
Well, if you felt it was too technical, please write us a letter and we will promptly ignore it.
Yep.
Because that's what we do on this podcast, except we don't get any letters.
And another thing I want to say is that I've been looking at games that I've played and enjoyed and sort of gone, oh, you know, that's a cool game and everything like that. But I am enjoying them in an entirely new way.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, and I said a very mean thing about Full Throttle.
What was that?
Ivan, which made him laugh. Which was, oh, it's finally got really challenging puzzles to solve. Which is in the artwork. Which, I'll be honest, you know, I don't... Full Throttle's got a few good puzzles that I like. But most of them, yeah, okay, you know. There's pixel hunts, there's annoying action bits, there's that stupid kick the wall
thing. I mean, to be fair, the fact that you're playing as a big tough biker guy kind of limits the scope of what kind of puzzles you can put in with regard to, like, oh, this is a mind-bending brain teaser, because a tough biker guy is not going to be there and be thinking about how to, you know, program something. Yeah. He's going to kick it, so...
And as a counter to everything that I've just said, I love solving puzzles.
Yes.
I really do. I genuinely love solving puzzles. And having said that, Full Throttle is my favorite adventure game.
Well, there you go.
So, you know, I can't say any further than that. But I'm enjoying it now in a totally new way. You know, I feel like I'm seeing things, small, delightful little things, a specific to me now that I know some stuff about art that I didn't when I played Full Throttle for the first time, for the second time, for the third time, etc.
For the 57th time.
Hey, it's okay. You've got to play things a lot to understand them.
I mean, Full Throttle only takes like 2 hours to play through, so...
But not if you do like I do and get every look response and everything like that. It's a nice world to explore.
Then it takes about 2.5 hours to play through.
Oh dear.
I'm sorry, Tim Schafer.
But yeah, so I'm not. You made it a fantastic game. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for making the game that has inspired me more than any others in terms of adventure games.
Do you know what made me laugh? Did you watch the little documentary thing that they released for the upcoming remaster of Full Throttle, right?
Yes.
I liked at the end when he's talking about how he always wishes that as a result of this game, someday he'll find himself in like a tough biker bar and they're about to beat him up. And they're like, hey, wait, didn't you make that game about the bikers? And he's like, yeah. And they'll be like, oh yeah. And then there's a beat and he goes, that game was too short. Boom, 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 boom.
That was a good bit.
I like that.
I also like that. That's another thing, you know. I'm excited about that remaster, mostly because I want to see the commentary.
Yeah.
Which is a really nerdy thing to say. I've become that guy.
Believe me, I was excited about the Day of the Tentacle commentary and the Monkey Island 2 commentary. The Monkey Island 2 Special Edition, the two things that made me most excited about it were the commentary and the remastered soundtrack with live instruments, as I've said many a time.
So. Yeah. Very good. I think I've said pretty much all I'm going to say.
Good. And I have nothing else further to contribute. So thank you for listening.
Yeah, we hope you're all doing well and welcome to 2017. We hope it's a good year for you.
Yeah, we hope it's better than 2016 was. If you want to follow us on Twitter, I forgot. It's been so long since we podcasted. I forget what our little exit spiel is. If you want to follow us on Twitter individually, I am Grundislav Games.
I am at @_wind. And together we are
Wild Stallions. Sorry, I was just fulfilling fan desires there.
I didn't even hear what you said because I was trying to promote our podcast Twitter account.
Oh, I said together we are Wild Stallions.
Oh, yes.
Yes, together we are at @BCT_podcast. Very good. Now, yes, thanks for listening. We'll probably be back at some point.
We'll probably do at least another podcast.
We'll probably do at least one other podcast in 2017.
Yeah, it seems likely.
Yes. All right. Very good. Bye.
Bye.